தாக்கிட்டத்தக்க தொமுக்கிட்ட தொமுக்கிட்டத்தக்க தெத்தா திட்டக்கத்த கதிகன தக்கிட்ட தக்கிட்ட தக்க கிட்டத்தக்க தொமுக்கிட்ட தொமுக்கிட்டத்தக்க தெத்தா தா தா தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க. This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socio-economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this episode, we speak with pediatric gastroenterologist Dr. Bittu Kanwar about how kids go.
You know, I think we are a stool-obsessed people.
Acupuncturist Chris Randall tells us about digestion in the elderly.
You have to have yin in order to be able to have a good yin time.
And a good friend, Mark, divulges his own digestive habits.
I would produce what they call the wipeless wonder.
First, did you know that Americans use an average of 24 rolls of toilet tissue per person per year, and less than 2% of the toilet paper used at home is made of 100% recycled fibers? In fact, despite the fact that we are in an economic depression, sales of soft and luxurious toilet paper are still increasing, according to marketing research done by Information Resources Incorporated. Millions of trees are cut throughout North America and Latin America, including trees from rare virgin old growth forests in Canada, to make soft toilet paper to wipe our bums with. Turns out tissue made from standing trees is much softer than tissue made from recycled fibers. As much as 22% of the pulp that Kimberly-Clark uses to make Cottonelle and Scott brands of TP comes from trees in Canadian boreal forests, where some trees are 200 years old. What a waste of trees, especially in an era of global warming. People in other countries seem to be far more sensible. Most people around the world just use water to clean themselves. In Europe and Latin America, about 20% of the home market of toilet paper is made from recycled fibers. It's still not great, but it's still 10 times better than the US. Soft tissue made from standing trees is not only a bummer for the tree, and the pun is fully intended, but it also requires a lot more water than making tissue from recycled fibers. This is super important because the world is running out of fresh water. Who needs soft toilet paper that we don't have any water to flush away? But for the moment, let's save the topic of flushing with gallons of water for another day. And then, to top it off, to make that soft white toilet paper, you have to use chlorinated chemicals to bleach out those old growth forest trees, which in turn gives us hermaphroditic male frogs that can reproduce with each other. In the final analysis, Dr. Alan Hershkowitz, a senior scientist and waste expert with the Natural Resources Defense Council, says no forest of any kind should be used to make toilet paper. And as the attending and consulting physician for Neijing Now, I refuse to carry a pager anymore, and still somehow I manage to attend the calls of nature regularly. After a lifetime of doing so, even before graduating from medical school, I have gathered some hot tips for inner hygiene. Consider the individual fight against constipation as the necessary medical and political movement that rivals public sanitation reform. Don't let civilization and the increasing lack of time it offers to obey the calls of nature be the cause of abdominal distension, disagreeable breath, a furred tongue, or an uptight humor. So, here we go, so to speak. Throw away that alarm clock and get a deep, restful sleep each night. Drink 2 liters of warm water first thing in the morning, unless you are on a fluid restriction as recommended by your physician. Clean that fetid fur off your tongue after you drink that warm water. Eat your breakfast sitting down in a leisurely manner. put some ground flaxseed and ground black sesame seed on your breakfast. Squat on the toilet to straighten your anatomy out and help move things along. Eat 5 pieces of fresh vegetable and fruit every day. A few slices of raw ginger before each meal and a few fennel seeds after each meal will go a long way or make your going a short stay. Walk at least 1/2 hour a day. Twist your abdomen now and again. Don't eat anything that comes in a package. Drink at least 1 liter of warm water throughout the rest of the day, and relax your mind and body as much as possible. Dr. Bittu Kanwar is an assistant adjunct professor of pediatrics in the Division of Gastroenterology at UCSF. He informs us about how to prevent the most common digestive issues in infants, children, and adolescents. Dr. Kanwar, would you be able to share with us some of the most common problems that kids have and what are the best ways to prevent those problems from happening?
As pediatric gastroenterologists, we see patients from birth up until 21 years of life. Throughout that course, food habits change. As kids grow, they're exposed to more things. So in the early stages, we see things such as milk intolerance. And then as kids transition to solids, oftentimes they'll have difficulties metabolizing those solid foods or even swallowing. And then as they get older and they're exposed to more things, especially in our culture, such as soda, chips, quote-unquote junk foods, we see them taking in too much, and then we're dealt with the problems of obesity.
So perhaps we should start off right at birth, and then for the first year or so, and then we'll go into early childhood and then adolescence.
So in the first year, when a child is an infant, one of the major problems we see is milk intolerance. That's cow's protein intolerance. And those children can present in many different ways. Sometimes they'll just be cranky. Sometimes they're vomiting. But it's when they start having more severe issues like the inability to gain weight or they're losing blood and or protein in their stools, that's when we get concerned. The prevalence of that disorder has increased over time. That's not to say that there's more people having it. I just think we're doing a better job of picking it up. With that being said, there's a lot of infants who are cranky and fussy and are perfectly normal. And so we have a lot of parents that will oftentimes come in and say, my child has a milk allergy, when they're just a little fussy, but their GI tract is completely normal.
Do babies with cow's milk allergy also sometimes manifest with rashes?
Absolutely. Kids who have those rashes or who have eczema are often more prone to having food allergies.
Is it advisable to offer infants cow's milk?
We as pediatricians recommend breastfeeding exclusively for the first year of life. Even if foods are introduced, the most ideal substrate for the infant is breast milk. And the way that they're exposed to the cow's protein is via mother's diet. If she's drinking cow's milk, they can be exposed to that protein, even though they're not, quote unquote, drinking cow's milk.
And what kind of proteins are used in formula?
So formula has 2 major proteins. Some formulas, of course, are made from soy, and the casein portion of the cow's milk is not in most formulas. It's going to be more of the whey portion, which is less allergenic.
It causes fewer allergies.
That's right. What should be noted as well, though, is in kids that do have a true cow's milk protein allergy, a lot of those kids, some studies would suggest as high as 50% to 60%, will be allergic to soy as well. If we think that those patients are truly allergic to cow's milk or cow's protein, we'll put them on specialized formulas that have no proteins, but rather just the single amino acids that make up those proteins. And those are specialized formulas.
And probably very expensive.
And very bad tasting as well.
You've tried them.
I've been forced to try them. And you can smell them. You don't even need to taste them. And you can tell that they're not very good. But of course, an infant will eat it if necessary.
Why are kids reacting to proteins in mother's milk?
Overall, there's been a new thought as to why we're seeing more allergic type of disorders, whether it's protein intolerance or asthma, even something as such as diabetes, where our body reacts in an abnormal way. And one of the main thoughts is that as our culture in particular has developed, we've limited the exposure to certain things in nature. One thing could be parasites, other things could be allergens, and it's predisposing us to these allergic type of reactions. That's only a theory, but it's fairly commonplace. It's called the hygiene hypothesis.
It's not that we're getting exposed to cow's protein in more quantities. It's that we are not getting exposed to enough other things to balance everything out.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We know that for centuries and centuries, people have been drinking cow's milk, albeit there may have been some infants who were never diagnosed with this or misdiagnosed. We still think that their numbers may still be increasing. So there's clearly some link. We know that all of the allergic diseases are on the rise. The one thing that makes us and our other Western countries different than, say, underdeveloped nations is that we don't have the exposure to certain things that they do.
This problem of cow's milk allergy is more of a Western problem.
It's more of a Western problem, and that's not to say that other children around the world may not be affected. The incidence is definitely higher in the West.
What about other things? Because babies also get diarrhea and they get constipated and they burp and vomit and fart. Some of it is just normal, right? And then some of it is not normal. So can you talk about those things?
25% of all referrals made to us are constipation. You know, one thing that's important to realize is everyone has a different definition of constipation, but a fair way to define it is the passage of a painful, hard stool.
Or what about just no passage of stool?
Or no passage of stool.
For how long?
It's interesting because if there is an infant who's breastfed, infants, newborns especially, do such a good job of extracting all the nutrients, all the minerals, all the fluid out of that breast milk that, believe it or not, it may be normal for a newborn to have one stool every 10 or 11 days. Some have 10 or 11 stools daily. It's hard for a parent to hear that. You know, they say after 3 or 4 days, I get worried. The longest I've seen in a completely normal newborn is 17 days without the passage of a stool.
Okay, people cannot see me, but my jaw is dropping.
Wide open, her jaws. And again, when that infant did pass a stool, it was soft. It was normal. It was non-bloody. It wasn't a hard rock, a chunk of clay. Child's digestive system was just doing such a good job at extracting the nutrients it needed, but there's no real duration of time. There's no frequency of stoolage per day that defines what we do. Passage of a hard, painful stool or passage of no stool with the urge to go would be considered constipation.
That's a very good guideline for people to keep in mind, is that it's not how often the stool is coming, but it's how the stool is passing. If it's passing easily without pain and it's normal without blood and mucus, then everything is okay. Nobody needs to panic.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I think we are a stool obsessed people. Yeah, I'm a gastroenterologist, so I'm definitely a stool obsessed person, but we base our stool pattern on our health. If it's consistent, if it's formed, if it's the right color, the right smell, we feel better about ourselves. And what may be normal for one person, which is maybe one stool every 4 days, may be abnormal to someone who has a stool after their morning coffee, then after their lunch, and after dinner. But they all may be still normal.
One of the most common problems, you're saying, in pediatric gastroenterology is constipation. Any other big ones?
So the other big ones, there is something called failure to thrive. All children should be growing until they reach puberty. Most parents and young people out there know what a growth chart is. When a child falls off that growth curve or ceases to gain weight, there could be multiple reasons why. But one of the reasons is, are they somehow inadequately absorbing the food that they take in, or are they losing more through their stool or vomiting or some other GI cause? So that's probably the second most common. We see now more common than either one of those two is the adolescent patient with abdominal pain. Sometimes there's a known reason for them to be having it. Sometimes we just don't know why they have it.
Tell us about how we should be preventing constipation.
That's a great question. Our diets have changed such that they're more processed than they have been in the past. We also don't have as much time to prepare not just nutritious, but maybe organic or traditional foods. The two things that one can do to prevent constipation is A, adequate amount of fluid, and then the second is an adequate amount of fiber. Those two things, in most cases, will prevent constipation or make one more regular.
What about in infants and in kids?
In infants, it's something a little different because in an infant, we want to always exclude a neurologic cause or an anatomic reason for the constipation. Once that happens, it's still more difficult because we don't like giving newborns anything other than breast milk. And the majority of those infants, if they just get adequate amounts of fluid, they do fine. The older child, the school-age child, we can say increase the amount of fluid intake, increase the amount of fiber.
So newborns and infants, should you give them extra water? What's the story on that?
For the majority of newborns, breastfeeding every 2 to 3 hours, 2 to 3 ounces at a time, if one were to pump, that should be adequate. A newborn and an infant, their gut neuronal axes aren't developed yet. You know, what is that? So when I or when you need to go...
Let's talk about you.
Okay, let's talk about me. When I need to poop, there's an urge, and that urge is sent up to my brain, and when it's socially appropriate, I will send a message from my brain to my GI tract and say, okay, let's do this. And there's appropriate muscles that relax and some other muscles that push, and out it comes. For a baby, they may know they need to go. They may feel that pressure, but when they push, their smooth muscle does not relax the way it would for, say, me. And that's why they seem to turn red. That's why they seem to scream. That's why they seem to be really pushing. It's normal. Normal.
So how long does it take for this brain-to-butt communication, those signals to get cleared up?
Generally by a couple of years, 2 to 3 years of age, most kids will know that they need to go.
And you mentioned something else about making sure that there isn't a neurological problem or an anatomical problem.
Again, a lot of times, just by asking the right question, one could be suspicious of some of those issues. For instance, 99% of infants stool by 48 hours of age.
If a newborn poops within the first 2 days, you probably don't need to worry about nerves or anatomy.
Less likely.
Great. Toddlers also often really don't want to poop, even though they have to poop, but they don't want to, and it's painful, and it's, you know, what about for them?
So the toddlers is a tricky one because you said it perfect. It's that cycle of constipation we see. A toddler or a school-age child has a painful poop. And like all of us who stick our hand in the fire once, we won't do it again. They say to themselves, well, it hurt last time I went. I don't want to go again. So that stool builds up. It builds up. As it's building up, all the fluid is being extracted from it. It turns into a hard ball, and suddenly we have ourselves a constipated child.
How can we prevent that from even happening in the first place?
Fiber and fluid. That's the broken record, and those are important things. So on your apple, keep the skin on it. Don't eat white rice. Go for the brown rice. Little changes can make a big impact and prevent constipation.
But most of the food that kids like are like macaroni and cheese, and they don't want to eat the good stuff. They want to eat the stuff that has less fibers.
That's true. The majority of kids out there like fruit. And then the other way that we can get fiber into our children is with cereal and oatmeal. And again, the majority of kids like it.
Part of it is probably also habit cultivation. So if you don't even introduce them to macaroni and cheese and more of the junky type foods, then they just cultivate a habit of eating the better foods.
That's right. You know, all these kids, they get their first bit of Cheerios or Doritos or whatever it may be. And, you know, they taste good. They do taste good. They taste oftentimes better than that carrot or celery stick. But especially in a young child, those foods have no nutrient value. I mean, there's no nutrition in them. With that being said, every kid at some point is going to need to have a treat. And so there's that fine balance.
But a lot of it is also what is defined as a treat. So if a treat is a mango or an orange or a papaya or a pineapple versus a donut.
That's true. That's absolutely right. When I was growing up, my treats were dried fruits, so the dried pineapples, and I love them. It's a very good point. And I think that by exposing children to those things, the ice creams and the candy bars and the chips and whatnot, and not completely restricting it from them, but teaching them moderation, that's probably the best way to handle it.
Yeah, absolutely. Moderation in everything. Another thing to think about is a treat doesn't always have to be something edible. It could be a walk in the park or a game of catch or singing a song together or making a painting or something else.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, even in our kids who are constipated, one of the things we teach them is, you know, every day we want you to sit on the toilet for 10 or 15 minutes. Just really try. Just focus on one thing. And the treat that they get at the end of that, it's not a food. It's rather a sticker. And the sticker system, believe it or not, is pretty effective. Treats do not necessarily have to be food. Treats can be a trip to the zoo.
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be so intensive as a big trip. It could just be, you know, do something that takes 5 minutes.
That's right, yeah. And so you're absolutely right. The other benefit of doing something that takes 5 minutes, especially if it involves walking or moving around, children need to be active. And the more active you are, whether you're running or walking, that too will help your GI system because those things make you poop.
Yeah, so just do a little song and dance routine in your living room. That's a nice treat.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the abdominal pain in adolescents.
Wow, it's one of the more challenging ones. Over 50% of the time, we cannot find a physiologic or pathologic cause. So we would classify them as functional abdominal pain. And those are kids who have chronic abdominal pain that occurs daily, if not weekly, and it's severe enough that it's affecting their quality of life for their daily activities.
They're functioning in the world.
They're functioning in the world, and the way it manifests is they're missing school. We don't know why this happens. We don't understand fully what's going on, but you know, we can correlate a lot of these things with the degree of stress a lot of these kids are feeling. It's easy to think that an eighth grade boy, why should they have stress? But there is stress. You know, there's stress from schoolwork. There's stress from parents. Oftentimes, there may be problems at home.
Or bullying at school, or the cliques that get formed and you feel left out, or you're not succeeding in extracurricular activities. I mean, the list is endless of what you can feel stressed about.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up bullying. Sometimes it's as direct as saying, are you being bullied? Are you scared? Is someone threatening you? And the reason it's difficult is because even when we say there's no inflammation, you don't have gastritis caused by a bacteria, you don't have a problem with the way food is moving through you, even when you reassure them with all that, the pain continues. That's the point where we elicit the help of other people, including behavioral therapists, adolescent medicine physicians, and in some instances, psychiatrists.
Well, and I would also offer that, as we learned about in the second part in this series on the functioning of the GI tract, in Chinese medicine and in Ayurvedic medicine, the different parts of the GI tract carry different emotions. Consulting an Ayurvedic physician or a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner could help illuminate some of the emotional aspects of what's held in the GI tract.
No, that's absolutely right. We live in a city, in a part of the world, where the approach to disease or sickness or ailments is really multifactorial. I know of many great integrative medicine places or alternative therapies where I've sent patients to before, and there was nothing that I was able to do for them to help them, but those places did. So it's a great thought.
Well, sometimes just coming at it from a different point of view can bring to light some of the emotions related to how the GI tract is functioning and why it's causing discomfort and pain.
Absolutely. And, you know, those traditions, you know, different cultural nuances, they've existed for a long time. When I was a kid, my grandmother always used to say that if you were feeling constipated, you need to drink tea. And she would say, but it can't have milk in it. It's got to be tea, and it's got to have this concoction of Indian spices in it. You have to do it first thing in the morning. It worked because the spices were stimulating some way, and I was doing it first thing in the morning, which was helping with a reflex that we all have. if it works and if it's safe, go for it.
Tell us about this reflex.
So this, it's called the gastrocolic reflex. As adults, we wake up, put on a pot of coffee, get the newspaper, drink our cup of coffee, and we have a bowel movement.
Boom, bada boom.
It's golden, right? You know, it's really not the cup of coffee. You could probably have a cup of orange juice and get the same reflex. As your stomach is stimulated with food, especially after a long period of not eating, it then stimulates everything to start contracting.
I'm going to take us back to functional abdominal pain. What can we do to prevent functional abdominal pain? This is a big one, I know. It's a very common problem. It should be recognized before putting adolescents through gazillion tests and endoscopies and colonoscopies and everything else. And the intervention can take place with, as you said, behavioral therapists, maybe psychiatrists, maybe alternative medicine people. But how can we help kids not have these problems?
There's no clinical or scientific data on how to prevent this problem from occurring. One thing that I've seen is oftentimes children that have abdominal pain that's functional in nature, there's a certain balance in their life that is not there. The child, the adolescent who's not active, they go to school, they come home, they sit on their computer, they sit on their PlayStation TV, they don't do anything. Oftentimes just telling them to get up and walk, do something for an hour a day, really improves that pain. The second thing is diet. Kids do not eat well. Kids who are eating flaming hot Cheetos, eating a lot of high acid foods, the lining of the stomach can get worn up and it hurts. And then the third, which is sort of harder to say, is don't let the stresses of your life, whether it's school or your parents, don't let it overwhelm you. And it's hard for us to do that as adults. But I think we need to reinforce it with the children, especially the adolescents. And one of the things that we should all try to facilitate is there are places that they can go talk to someone because they do have stress in their life. There's no tablet you can take to prevent this. There's no foods you can eat to prevent this. But I think it's just general well-being, be active, eat healthy.
Absolutely. And I think also we could speak to parents. If a parent has a child who's having functional abdominal pain, that perhaps they could look at their interparental harmony or the harmony in the household, or that they should maybe think about the school environment and is the child fearful? A lot of schools now, there's a lot of pressure for drugs and alcohol and sex and smoking, and there's a lot of things that we should think about earlier.
That's right. I had a patient that I've been seeing for 3 or 4 months with abdominal pain, and it wasn't until I said gangs that he kind of for once looked at me directly in the eye and said, yeah, there's a gang problem and I'm scared. You know, that was beyond my scope of what I could handle at that time. So our team social worker came in and spoke to him and the family and gave them resources, and we're working on making his life safer, which in turn will hopefully make his abdominal pain better. There's a lot of dangers out there, even for 11 and 12-year-old kids.
Kids are very sensitive, and they can feel disharmony and threats very easily.
Absolutely. You know, if you don't ask it, you're not going to get it. So you need to just be very straightforward, and parents should do the same. There are things out there that there weren't 20, 30 years ago.
But people were still having functional abdominal pain 20 or 30 years ago because disharmony persists throughout the world in every culture. There's wars, there's communal disharmony, there's poverty, there's probably the most common is family violence or parental discord. The point being that stomach aches are not always a medical quote-unquote thing, that often and sometimes it's just a reflection of life and the way we're living life, which includes diet and exercise and activity, but also the sense of security in the world, your sense of accomplishment in the world, your capacity to manage the demands that are being placed on you, how supported you feel by your network of friends and family, how much time you have to sleep and relax and recreate yourself.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up sleep. Show me an adolescent that sleeps 8 hours and I won't believe it. But it's with the help of a pediatrician or, you know, a primary care provider, they can help determine if it may be something more quote unquote serious, or should I say pathologic in nature. It may be physiologic in nature rather than something related to an external force. Well, just to reiterate, diarrhea with abdominal pain, vomiting with abdominal pain, fevers with abdominal pain, weight loss with abdominal pain, those are all reasons that may indicate something more serious.
Yeah. And at the same time, I'd like to just say that being threatened by a gang at your school is pretty serious too.
Yeah, maybe serious is the wrong word. I'd say that may indicate a medical pathology. Yeah, gangs and bullies and drugs, those are all extremely serious things.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Drink water and eat lots of fiber.
Fiber and fluids, fiber and fluids, fiber and fluids.
You know, just doing the right thing, eating the right foods, exercising, drinking plenty of fluid and getting your fiber.
And living in a world of peace.
Living in a world of peace and, you know, a utopia that exists somewhere.
Well, resolving these conflicts that we're talking about, the family conflicts and school conflicts, and learning to live with each other in a harmonious way.
Yeah. Be good to your body and be good to each other, and it will make a big difference.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Kanwar.
Well, thank you very much. And it was wonderful meeting you. And I think you're doing good stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bittu Kanwar, pediatric gastroenterologist at UCSF. Chris Randall is a licensed acupuncturist. He educates us about the traditional Chinese medical perspective on the most common digestive problem in the elderly. Dr. Randall, welcome to Neijing Now.
Thank you, Dr. Chandar.
Please tell us about the common problems in digestion and elimination experienced by the elderly.
Well, most people have the issue of constipation. This is a big issue in older people. 65 and above. And the big reason in Chinese medicine terms is because of yin deficiency. Yin deficiency can lead to digestive issues for several reasons. One is because you need to have fluid in order to transform and transport any food that's in the stomach. In order to turn the bolus into chyme, you have to have liquid. You have to have water. The enzymes that are in the stomach, the gastric juices, they also are in an aqueous solution. If you don't have enough, then what happens is peristalsis it's slowed down, basically, and can get stuck in the large intestines. Now, the large intestines, of course, with all of the microvilli, have the job of pulling out the fluid. When there's a lack of fluid to begin with, then the feces are not going to move after the microvilli pull out the water. And it's the fluid that contains all of the nutritional matter of that food. That is to say, after the food gets digested, the fluid is what holds the nutrients. So it's the job of the small intestines and the large intestines to do absorption.
So the intestines are what are extracting the nutrition from the food, which is now the sludge.
Absolutely.
So what I hear you saying is that primarily in the elderly population, they don't have enough fluid, and that's what's causing the most common problem experienced by the elderly, which is constipation.
Absolutely. Now, in Chinese medicine, we call this yin deficiency, this lack of fluid, and in many cases, lack of blood, because blood is the primary fluid in the body. Then there is the issue of nutrition, that is, the food that goes in also needs to have water, and we need to put water in. The question is, why do people become yin deficient? What leads to yin deficiency?
Thank you. That was going to be my question.
One way that people get to be yin deficient is by using up their yin. And one thing that happens is toxicity. Over-toxicity uses fluids. It takes water out of the cells. Unless a person has enough water to use to dilute the toxins that come in. In physiology, we say the solution to pollution is dilution. And essentially, that what that means is the fluid in the body dilutes the toxins that are in the blood.
So you're saying that the main reason that people get yin deficient is from toxins?
Well, this is a Western way to view an ancient problem. This is not new. People tend to get drier as they get older. One reason that happens is because of toxicity, especially in our day and age. 5,000 years ago, okay, there were fewer toxins, that's true. But today, there are toxins everywhere, and because those toxins come into the body, there are only a couple of ways that the body has to deal with those toxins. And one way is to dilute the toxins so that the toxins can be ejected from the body easier. They can be excreted without much ado. That doesn't always happen because when we get dehydrated, then it's harder to deal with this toxicity. And the water that needs to be in the bloodstream in order to dilute the toxins has to come from somewhere. And if it doesn't come from our diet, our food, and the water we intake, then it's coming from inside the cells, which means the cells themselves are giving off water that they don't have, that they can't spare.
So it sounds like there's a simple solution to this problem. Let's just drink more water.
That's what we tell our patients every single day. Drink more water. However, there's another component to it, and that is the absorption of that water. Because what can often happen is, and older people tend to find this, because they're already dry, simply drinking water is not going to solve the problem. And the reason is because in Chinese medicine, we say that yin deficiency is like a desert. When you pour water on the desert doesn't simply absorb the water. It sits there. It's like a dry sponge. It doesn't get to the tissue, which is the point. And when people put in fluid, they don't have enough minerals to cause the kidneys to absorb that water. They simply urinate the water out and they continue to be dehydrated. While they have done a service to their kidneys in terms of flushing their kidneys, they haven't done a service to their cells in terms of absorption.
So the key then, it sounds like, is not to drink water, but to drink water that has electrolytes and minerals.
Absolutely. That's it.
Normal tap water has minerals in it.
That may be true. Normal tap water probably also has a good deal of toxins in it as well, which then causes the reverse issue.
That sounds like it's two steps forward, two steps backward. So what do you recommend when it comes to water?
One thing they can do is take a pinch of salt and put it under their tongue, which is a fabulous solution because what it does is it signals immediately to the brain that the body has salinity and needs to hold water in. So the kidneys, it tells the kidneys to hold water in instead of sending it to the bladder.
That's interesting. So you don't need to actually make the water saline. You don't need to put the salt in the water. You just need to signal to your brain by putting the taste of salt on your tongue to tell your body to hang on to the water.
That's it. Now, you can do it either way. The problem with having people put salt in the water is that they won't drink it. Salt water is not as tasty as fresh water.
Well, and the other component to that is that the elderly often suffer from high blood pressure or may even have swelling in their legs and things like that. And so in Western medicine, we tell them to avoid salt to not raise their blood pressure. So drinking water with salt in it doesn't sound like a good idea for those people.
Right, which is why we say just put the salt under the tongue, and that will help the tissue absorb water and the kidneys reabsorb water.
Why under the tongue and not on the tongue?
Because it'll get absorbed, whereas if you put it on top of the tongue, you might just wash it away with the water. But we tell them put the salt under the tongue after drinking the water. So the water is already into the system and going through to the kidneys, and then the salt goes in order to signal the holding of the water, the reuptake of that water.
Great, that's interesting.
Fascinating. In terms of yin deficiency, the way to build up yin is, well, the primary yin is blood, and blood is mostly water, so you have to build up water. But there are other ways to build up yin. Rather than talking about all of the Chinese medicine forms of treatment, the number one form of treatment in Chinese medicine, it's nutrition and exercise. So we show people exercises that they can do to help build their blood, namely compression of bones, long bones, because long bones are the place where blood cells are born.
doesn't yin deficiency also imply some sort of exhaustion, and wouldn't rest and relaxation also help to counteract yin deficiency?
For sure. In fact, in Chinese medicine, nighttime is yin time. And in order to rebuild yin as well as blood, it turns out, you have to sleep. You have to have a good sleep. That's when the blood is produced, and many other things. Many things happen at night, including the body's regenerating itself, particularly with blood.
Often elderly people have difficulty sleeping, so that probably makes the problem worse.
It's a vicious cycle, because you have to build blood in order to have a good sleep. In Chinese medicine, we say you have to have yin in order to be able to have a good yin time. And nighttime is yin time, whereas during the day, that's called the yang time, when the sun is out. But when the moon is out, that's the yin time. In order to have a restful sleep, you need to have enough blood. In fact, we commonly see people with the Western diagnosis of anemia or some blood disorder and insomnia through the roof. And they go hand in hand. So it makes perfect sense. Yin deficiency can lead to insomnia, but then insomnia and lack of sleep, that is lack of yin time, can also exacerbate yin deficiency and yin deficient symptoms. Constipation being a major one, but the process of digestion in the stomach and in the intestines also being greatly impaired by yin deficiency. And it becomes a vicious cycle, because then if you can't sleep, then you can't build blood, and you continue to be further dehydrated and yin deficient.
If we were going to begin a virtuous cycle and prevent problems with digestion and elimination, particularly for elderly people, the three topmost recommendations: drink water, number one. Number two, exercise, particularly exercise that involves your long bones. And number three, sleep well.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. That's it.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Chris. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. You've been very generous. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chander.
Chris Randall, licensed acupuncturist and traditional Chinese medicine practitioner from the Oakland Community Acupuncture Clinic. My good friend, who we will call Mark, bravely divulged the details of his digestive habits for the benefit and progress of humanity. Mark, welcome to Neijing Now.
It's my pleasure.
Would you like to tell us about your digestion and elimination?
Well, there's so much to tell. I'm wondering where you'd like me to start.
Why don't you start from the top?
When I was a kid...
No, I mean, how about why don't we start from chewing and swallowing?
Oh, that top. Well, I like to eat food. I like tasty food, and I like strong tastes, like lime pickle. And I find that one of the things that's most troubling about my own eating is that I like to just put it all in there and get it in. I like the feel of swallowing.
So you prefer swallowing to chewing?
I do.
So what you're saying is that you don't really chew very well?
Not much of a chewer.
Okay, do you know why that is?
It's that desire to get it down my throat. It has to do with anxiety, I think, and some kind of fulfillment urge.
Because you feel full when you have food in your stomach, so you like that feeling of feeling full.
It's actually not about my stomach at all. In fact, for a long time, when I was in college, which is some time ago, I realized that I had to take extra attention to understand whether I was hungry or full. I might feel lightheaded, which was a clue that I was hungry, but full was kind of irrelevant. I would eat for the pleasure of eating and swallowing. I might not even notice whether I had liked it or not, like the flavor, but I would have gotten it in there and that would have been satisfying.
So it's almost irrelevant to you what you're eating in terms of taste or even nutrition. It's more just that you get to eat.
It's not that it's irrelevant, because there are so many facets in operation. The driving urge is to eat.
So how do you think that affects your digestion and elimination?
I really don't know. I do know that it means that I eat more than I need to. I'm aware that I'm sated with my belly, but not sated with my brain.
Okay, so then do you have any symptoms like reflux or acid or indigestion or flatulence or, you know, any of these things that might indicate there's a disturbance in your digestion?
I think I'm strangely lucky with gastric constants. My habits of digestion and elimination are not very perturbed by what I eat. One interesting thing is that my patterns changed very drastically, very quickly, during 1 week of my life, and it's never been the same since.
Okay, now you have my interest. What happened in this one particular week of your life?
I crossed the country and went to live in California. And while I was living on the East Coast, I had lived there until I was 25, I would be on the constipated side of things. I would not eliminate much, once a day maybe, sometimes not. If I went away, I might not eliminate for a weekend. And then, over the course of the week of driving across the country to go to graduate school, I found that I had very little to eliminate that whole time. And then when I got to graduate school, my stools softened, became much more regular, much more often. That was 20 years ago, and it's stayed the same since.
So what was the big change? Obviously, you changed your location and you changed what you were doing, but what else changed?
Dr. Chandler, it is a mystery.
Okay, were you more relaxed?
I found that with the West Coast, I was no longer seen as a foreigner, which is strange because I am a transplant to the West Coast. I was no longer seen as strange, and I felt relaxed in California. But I don't think that could have happened quick enough for that immediate change the second week in August of 1989.
So you don't think that it's related to just feeling at ease in California, feeling like accepted, because especially in the Bay Area, anything goes and everyone's welcome.
That's the only correlate I could imagine. I think that I don't give it that much significance.
Well, did your diet change? People do eat differently out here in California.
It's true, but I was eating similarly before and after, and I've had much more of a diet change since then, which hasn't affected my elimination much. I ate a lot of dairy and vegetable and very little meat, both before and after I crossed the country. And then not too long after that, I became vegetarian by habit for about 4 years. And then right now I eat a lot of meat. Those changes didn't cause a change in what came out the other end.
You also have not noticed any difference in your digestion.
That's correct. Although gradually as I've gotten older, my digestion has gotten a little less insensitive to the world. For instance, I almost never have diarrhea. Almost never vomit at all. I can count the times I have since I was a child on my hand, one hand. I don't burp a lot. I fart quite a bit.
More than normal?
I don't know. The three other people in my family fart similarly or more than I do.
Okay, no burping, normal amount of farting, no acid reflux or...
Acid reflux when I'm going through times of tension in my personal life or my work life. Not more than 3 days in a row and not more than one event a month of 1 to 3 days.
You do have some reflux symptoms, and they occur in times of tension. And are those times of tension also times when you might be eating more?
Good question. I don't know the answer, but it might be the case.
What do you eat? Do you eat a lot of whole, unprocessed foods, or do you eat things that are kind of packaged and in boxes and quick and ready to go?
I don't eat a lot of ready-to-go stuff. I eat, maybe I do, I eat Trader Joe's food, things like that. So it's pretty high quality, but it's not prepared by me other than cooking it for a brief time.
So it's still whole grains, high fiber, you know, real vegetables. It's real food, just that you didn't cook it.
That's my belief. I do eat quite a bit of salads, American type salad with nuts and maybe a little bit of cheese, tomatoes, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, maybe boiled egg and some cheese, perhaps dried fruits.
With all the green leafies.
With all the green leafies like spinach or whatever mixes.
Now, with all that beautiful food, it sounds like the only thing is that you don't chew it and taste it before it goes down.
Right. I don't eat a lot of fruits. I do eat a lot of meat. I think that's probably not very wise.
And do you chew your meat?
I do chew it. I mean, I do chew everything, but I'm not chewing it in an appreciative, relaxed way. It's a little bit frantic.
You mentioned earlier that the franticness may be related to anxiety, but could it also be related to perhaps not reserving enough time to eat?
Yeah, it definitely has that character in it, but I've done this since I was little, since a day that was simpler and less frantic with routine. But I think it's really my nature so much. It may be learned or innate or some combination, but I think it's how I've been for most of my life.
Is everybody in your family a fast eater?
The family that I am parenting? No. My children are not such fast eaters, and my husband is not a fast eater. I think the family I grew up in, more of us were fast eaters. But I think I was the fastest.
And did your family of origin reserve plenty of time for a meal?
We did. Maybe not breakfast, but dinner definitely was a leisurely occasion.
And still you would finish quickly.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about your digestion and elimination? Tell us about your fluid intake.
I drink a lot of water and I go on and off coffee. A couple months on, a couple months off. Most of my adult life was off coffee. Parenting has given me an excuse for the boost. I find that coffee does actually affect my elimination.
How so?
I think I have less digesting food inside of me when I'm drinking coffee. There's less stored or processed. Maybe it goes through faster.
It helps you eliminate, actually. It helps you to evacuate more of the contents of your colon.
Correct, and I like that.
Why do you like it?
I feel like the amount of food I carry around is a bit of a burden. It's heavy. It makes me larger. And I feel lighter and more free without the food still in me, or the food and post-food items.
That's very well put. Very articulate. Thank you. Coffee actually helps you eliminate everything. You feel lighter. You feel more energetic. You feel happier.
I wouldn't say happier, but more physically comfortable.
Great. And so how does that affect your anxiety and the desire to eat?
I haven't found that it affects my desire to eat, but I haven't thought about it. And I would like to start thinking about it starting now.
Well, it's kind of interesting because coffee is a stimulant. And if somebody was suffering from anxiety, we might ask them to avoid coffee. However, if it's helping you to eliminate more and you're feeling more comfortable and perhaps more at ease, then that might be a positive thing for your anxiety. And caffeine is also an appetite suppressant, and that might also influence how much you would want to eat.
I'm very into this. I'm going to pay attention now. Thank you.
It's totally counterintuitive. And even as a doctor, I would never tell a patient to use coffee as a laxative, especially a patient who had anxiety. I would tell them to avoid coffee. I don't want our listeners to get the impression that this is something I would recommend. In general, coffee can actually, over the long term, because of its stimulant effect and anxiety-producing effect, can actually be detrimental to effective elimination.
I can also say that I don't like the dependence on coffee, so there's certainly a downside in my own experience.
That's good.
Fair enough.
Do you have any concerns about your digestion and elimination?
Well, I think that, you know, I've watched my children go through toilet training, you know, from the beginning to later. And it's funny seeing them develop shame and embarrassment, and as well as, you know, more skill in managing their elimination, especially, and digestion and eating. I think that I'm 45 now and I still haven't finished becoming comfortable with the whole process. And I think that is another thing in my life that I enjoy as I get older, just understanding the whole process better and how it works for me.
What are the parts that you're still trying to become skilled and comfortable with?
Social aspects of eliminating, like public restrooms.
Tell me about that.
Do I have to?
No, you don't have to. Tell me about the other parts.
Well, I'll try anyway. Noises, when I eliminate in a restroom, that can be embarrassing, but I've gotten to the point where I'm not so embarrassed anymore because I've taken enough data that other people do that. It's expected, I realized. Cleanliness, when I was more constipated, I would produce what they called the wipeless wonder. And that is no longer a privilege that I enjoy anymore.
That is so funny. I've never heard it. The wipeless wonder.
One of my college roommates called it that.
So now you have some concerns about how to maintain scrupulous hygiene.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to manage that?
I think that water is a good trick. In the United States, we do not use bidets much. It's just a toilet paper culture, and I'm not sure that's so great. One interesting trick is that when my children were still in diapers, we used flushable, disposable wipes, and I still do sometimes.
Great. Congratulations. I highly recommend water. And with the Western commode, sometimes it's very difficult to use water. On a squatting toilet, it's much easier to use water. So, yes, the baby wipes that you can flush down the toilet are one option. Another option, which I sometimes do in a public restroom even, is to grab the paper towels and wet them and take them in with me. You cannot flush those down the toilet. They will be very bad for the plumbing. They will clog things up. So don't flush those. Well, that's a very legitimate concern, because actually maintaining scrupulous hygiene in the area is very important for preventing hemorrhoids and fissures and just general comfort as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's such a taboo about talking about any of this. Why am I discovering this, you know, this late in life? I try to give my children the benefit of talking about things a little bit more relaxed and letting them know that it shouldn't be so taboo. I don't know where the taboo comes from, whether it's just innate to humans as we mature. Is it a developmental thing or is it entirely social? I don't know, but I try to counteract that some to give them a little bit of a acceleration in their life, wisdom around their own bodies.
That's great. That's wonderful. I also think there's a little bit of phobia around using water in your hands and some idea that you won't be able to wash your hands sufficiently, but we're all capable of doing that, and many people all around the world do. Was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, thank you.
Mark, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. It's very generous of you to share the details of your digestion and elimination with us. You've been very forthright and honest, and I'm grateful to you for sharing with us.
I'm also grateful for your program, and it's been a nice thing to be interviewed by you.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My brave and good friend, Mark. Our concluding poem. Fire, fed by an unseen anger, screaming forth to a river of blood, burning unknown sorrows with the fury of an unnamed fear. Don't dare to douse this blaze that seeks untamed ways. Titled, Ode to My Ulcer. Nanjing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website set up and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by GC Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions. Found at gypsyjays.net. gypsyjays.net. You can find us on the web at nanjingnow.org. NEIJINGNOW.ORG. Naging Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these programs are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.